Venerable Kusala and I just came back from Chitrist. It was a very enjoyable time helping to take down the coach house. Well, the coach house is now, most of it's down to ground level. We spent the weekend and another 3 days, 5 days in total, working every day, knocking the walls down and sorting the stones to sizes, chipping the stones, cleaning the stones. Very, very enjoyable, lovely sangha. It's very well organized, nice and peaceful. Every muscle in my body hurts, and I discovered muscles I didn't know I had. So I'm very much out of shape. On the first day of work, I went to the forest at 7:30. I was so tired, I just thought I'd lay down, just to rest the body. I looked at the ceiling for 2 hours, and then I decided to go to sleep. And pain in the body. But mentally and emotionally, it was very joyous to be with a group of people who are doing something very beautiful, doing it together as a community. There were no egos floating around, not very visible at least. No sense of competition, no kind of manic rushing around. Very, very beautiful thing to be doing. Simple, very simple. And just the joy of that was nice to see. Nice to be with Ajahn Suchito, who was one of my favorite monks. Yeah, love him dearly. And to see how much he's put into Chithurst and how hard he works to create a beautiful environment where many people can practice, take precepts, get it, have the requisites to practice. So I think it'll be a lovely, it's already started out as a lovely Dharma hall. We'd start the work by chanting Jayanto 3 times. Finish the work by chanting Jayanto. So I had a very kind of meditative feel about it. So everyone sends their best wishes and chanting. Death of Venerable Piyadasi. I think he did 18 tours of the world. He went around the world at 18 different times teaching Dhamma. So dedicated to spreading Dhamma. And he's perhaps one of Sri Lanka's more famous teaching monks. I guess his most famous book is The Buddha's Ancient Path. I suppose that's very well known. And I remember him, he had this beautiful one-liner, "Trust in Dhamma, leave the rest to Kamma." That's how he starts. A lovely line, "Trust in Dhamma, leave the rest to Kamma." He stayed in New Zealand for quite a while with us, and he visited the St. Chitra's Amaravati several times. The observance day then is the way we punctuate our life in a monastery. Not quite the same as a worldly weekend where one puts down work and has fun. Different kind of punctuation. It's more a remembrance, an observance, remembering our life, remembering our rules, remembering our aspiration. Remembering that it is a religious life, because we are involved in a religious aspiration, not simply in some kind of emotional comfort or intellectual security. There is a goal in Buddhism, as there I think is in all religions, a realization, a profundity of seeing that it is a possibility for human beings. And hopefully that's what we're all involved in. In Northern Europe, we're not a faith culture. We're very much a critical culture. And my beginnings in religion began more in India and Thailand. My first Vasa was in 1973. as a Samanera in a place called Wat Tham Senkpet, which is a branch monastery of Ajahn Chah. And I was young and keen and fired up to get enlightened. And my first vasa was an absolute disaster. Because I took the whole idea of aspiration in a very egotistical way. Reading about the enlightenment of the Buddha, and reading that I am that at that time also, and different kinds of, what else was there? There was the autobiography of a yogi and all these very inspiring, magical, awesome books and beings about. So I thought, yeah, I want to go for that. That sounds good. And although I had had some profound experiences in India, I wanted to repeat them, but the repetition of those was unfortunately based, or my attempt to repeat them was based upon desire to become. And so my first vasa, I decided to, one of the things, you know, we have these Tudong practices, the ascetic practices, the Dina ascetic practices as well. I think I did about 14 or 15. I was going to do them all. I was going to do more. And then ended up deciding that I wasn't going to speak for 2 weeks. And so I practiced very hard and did sitting, walking, meditation. So I had a lot of willpower and I had a lot of determination. I had a lot of testosterone too, I think. That was a problem. But through my efforts, I managed to not basically sleep very little for 2 weeks. And then at the end of the 2 weeks, Ajahn Chah came to the monasteries. It's a branch monastery, and usually there were just a few monks. And he arrived with about 20 monks and 200 lay people, and it was this big dana, big gathering, big do. And I had just finished this very Sadhitana, and the food had just been passed out, and all of a sudden I found myself on the floor. The monks were sitting on a raised dais eating their food, and I found myself having a seizure. My body went rigid, my head went into a window, I kept my head in the window, I fell forward onto the ground into the lap of all these lay people. Ajahn Prabhakara jumped down and took my bowl strap, shoved it into my mouth so I wouldn't bite my tongue off. It was spectacular. And I ended up having to go to a little clinic where they didn't have any anesthesia. And they had this kind of carpet needle, which then they stitched my head up with a few stitches. It was really painful. So after this kind of horrendous day, late afternoon, and finally I kind of stagger out of this little clinic and there was an Esso station there, and the Esso station owner was a disciple of Ajahn Chah, named Sangchak. And Sangchak, and Ajahn Chah was sitting there in the Esso station drinking a Pepsi, which is one of the preferred drinks of monks in Thailand. Drinking this Pepsi and looking at me, and I'm sort of absolutely staggered and stunned, and he says to me, "Take it easy." Which is good advice. So that was my first lesson in wrong effort. And often, it's kind of comical when I look back on it. It was very agonizing and painful at the time. So aspiration without wisdom is a disaster. But if we have no aspiration and we have no faith, of course, then we're very much lacking, like a culture that doesn't have any sense of awe, any sense of the religious, any sense of other, other in the sense of something other than my own manipulations of the environment to get pleasure, or my manipulations of thought to get ideas which I think are supreme, some sense of other, something other than my own ego, my own analysis, my own personal preferences and opinions, some sense of awe, faith. This, when a culture lacks that, it lacks, for me, it lacks a vibrancy, it lacks depth, it lacks the bridges. And I think it's not very healthy. Because our own selfish desires and selfish technologies and selfish limited views of life can never really fully satisfy the yearnings of the heart. And we'll always be in a sense of imbalance until our yearnings are fully satisfied. And they can only be satisfied in the religious dimension. I don't think they can be satisfied at the emotional dimension, or at the intellectual dimension, or the social dimension. At least that's my view of it. But I think the ideas around faith are important to contemplate. So I picked out a few bits about, first of all, say Ajahn Chah, on the way he, his sense of faith and aspiration. So I thought I'd read that out first of all. Paul Ma is the name of Ajahn Chah's father, and in this section is his father is dying and Ajahn Chah is taking care of him. When Paul Ma discovered that Lompo's, and this is Lompa Cha, not Lompo Sumedho, when Paul Ma discovered that Lompo's exams would take place shortly, he urged him to, these were monastic examinations, would take place shortly, he urged him to return to his wat. But this request was refused. Instead, Lompo helped to nurse his father for the 13 more days and nights that the old man lingered on. It was December when the days have a drained, subdued tone and a cold wind blows across the Isan from China. When first thing in the morning everyone lights fires outside their houses to warm themselves and the Juhar carts anchored high in the air utter their melancholy cry throughout the night. Finally, one day, poor Ma's labored breath stopped, making the wind outside the house sound even louder. It seems clear that the death of poor Ma precipitated a crisis in Lompo's life. While nursing his father, truths that Lompo had been studying academically found a grounding in his experience. The human body is a mere conglomeration of the elements of solidity, fluidity, heat, and vibration, the inevitability of old age, sickness, and death, prominent features of passages learned by rote in the wat. He now saw as concise, undeniable articulations of the nature of his own father's life, and such teachings found a deep resonance in his heart. On return to Wat Ba Nong La, after the funeral, Lompo's concentration on his studies was frequently interrupted by vivid images of those days. The sufferings of his father's emaciated body in his final days, life's abrupt cessation, the stiff and doll-like corpse his father had become, and its growing smell, the shards of bone amongst the cremation ashes, such memories must have welled up within him constantly. He felt imbued by a profound and sober sense of sadness, determined to dedicate his life to the Dhamma and to be free of the cycle of conditioned existence. He made a solemn resolve, "I dedicate my body and mind, my whole life, to the practice of the Lord Buddha's teachings in their entirety. I will realize the truth in this lifetime. I will let go of everything and follow the teachings. No matter how much suffering and difficulty I have to endure, I will persevere. Otherwise, there will be no end to my doubts. I must make this life as even and continuous as a single day and night. I will abandon attachments to mind and body and follow the Buddha's teachings until I know their truth for myself." As a result, Lompo started practicing meditation more seriously, but not without difficulties. This is Lompo speaking. "The first year of meditation, I got nothing from it. My mind just teemed with thoughts about things I wanted to eat, It was really hopeless. Sometimes during a sitting, it would be as if I was actually eating a banana. I could feel it in my mouth. There have been defilements in the mind for many lifetimes. When you come to discipline it, there's bound to be a struggle. And this, in further on in the biography, this is a one episode. The Buddha taught monks to constantly recollect the fragility of life and the ever-present threat of death. At night, they must reflect on all the various ways they might die before the following dawn. Snake bites, scorpion bites, an awkward fall, appendicitis. The list is so willingly long, perhaps endless. Dwelling in tropical forests, where one's insecurity is palpable and virtually impossible to forget, is particularly conducive to this kind of contemplation. Some days after leaving Lumpur Mun, so Ajahn Chah had just visited Lumpur Mun for about 4 days. Some days after leaving Lumpur Mun, Lompo had his first direct encounter with the fact that, just as a gambler, irrespective of the length of his current winning streak, faces the same odds every time he throws a dice. Similarly, the fact that we have escaped death every day of our lives so far in no way weighs the odds in favor of our future survival. Although few animals share man's wanton aggressiveness, if they have been startled or feel threatened, they may well attack to defend themselves. One night, in a thick forest in Nakhon Phnom, a roving pack of wild dogs caught the scent of Lone Paul as he sat meditating in his grot. The grot is an umbrella with a tubular mosquito net around it. The motionless form of a cross-legged monk must have been a strange and unsettling sight to them. Within a few moments, Lone Paul was jerked from calm solitude to face a snarling mass of angry creatures, a mosquito net his only protection. Fear coursed through his body. With a supreme effort, Lone Paul steadied his mind, and then, following the ancient tradition, made a solemn resolution. I did not come here to hurt anyone or anything. I have come to practice Dhamma in order to realize liberation from suffering. If I have ever oppressed you in a past life, then kill me, so that I may pay off my debt. But if there is no bad blood between us, then please leave me in peace. Lone Paul closed his eyes. It was true, how swiftly, unexpectedly, and how easily death could come. The wild dog circled his grot, howling fiercely and baring their teeth, racing in to lunge at him from all sides, only to be confused by the thin cotton net that enclosed him. As soon as one of them dared to bite through it and expose the net's flimsiness, Lone Paul knew it would be the end, and he was afraid once more. Then suddenly, out of the thick blackness of the night, Lumpur Mun appeared. Now this isn't at Lumpur Mun's monastery, this is a forest far away. Lumpur Mun appeared, holding aloft a blazing torch, and walking straight toward the wild dog. Halting at Lone Paul's grot, he scolded him sharply, "Go, leave him alone." He lifted a length of wood as if to strike them, and the dog, stunned and thrown into disarray, ran off. Lone Paul, relieved and grateful to Lumpur Mun for saving him, opened his eyes to a scene of complete darkness and silence. I'd like to speak about that, but that's Ajahn Chah's resolution. And this is a Christian resolution. This is from Brother Charles of Jesus, who was a monk who decided to live as a desert father in Algeria. And I think he lived as a hermit for about 10 years, and he was killed by a Bedouin tribesman, I think. And this is in the Christian format. Father, the title is Father. I abandon myself into your hand. Do with me what you will. Whatever you may do, I thank you. I am ready for all. I accept all. Let only your will be done in me. And in all your creatures, I wish no more than this, O Lord. Into your hands I commend my soul. I offer it to you with all the love of my heart, for I love you, Lord, and so need to give myself to surrender myself into your hands without reserve and with boundless confidence, for you are my Father. I am ready for all, I accept all. So that's in the a Christian way of talking, I think. And this is a very simple way. Many of you read I Am That, the Sagadatta. This is one of his ways where he answers the question, am I permitted to ask you, how did you go beyond the mind, Maharaj, by the grace of my Guru? Question. What shape did his grace take? Maharaj, he told me what is true. What did he tell you? He told me I am the Supreme Reality. What did you do about it? I trusted him and remembered it. Is that all? Yes, I remembered him. I remembered what he said. You mean to say that this was enough? What more needs to be done? It was quite a lot to remember the Guru and his words. And this is the simple, direct approach of Advaita Vedanta. You are truth. You are the Supreme Reality. And I hope that's not all confusing, with different traditions and so on, but what I'm trying to point to is whenever we read about these great saints, is they have this deep aspiration for the truth, the spiritual truth. You know, it's not just some kind of comfort zone they're looking for, obviously, because inevitably in their practices they face difficult things. And then there is this kind of strength of resolution. For the Christian, it's I accept all. For Lompo Cha, it's if I've done any business with you, eat me, kill me. You know, this is incredible willingness to die for the Dhamma. And this is the ideas of Kamma. Advaita Vedanta, you are the truth. Just remember that. So that we have these different approaches in the spiritual traditions, and whether you like theistic tradition or you don't, it's not really the point of what I'm trying to maybe put across here. But the need for, first of all, in religion there is aspiration, and what is that? In Buddhism, it's the end of suffering, the realization of Nibbana. And there is this kind of faith, this trust and this faith which takes us beyond our limitations, beyond the limits of self. And there's a paradox that exists in Buddhism. It's the obvious paradox that you have this aspiration for truth, and yet it can't be done with desire and fear. So there's this necessity to abandon desire and fear and yet sustain one's aspiration. And that is something which took me a long time to really understand, like to how to put forth effort in a way which was not based upon bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, kama tanha, which was not based upon craving to become something or get rid of something. And the struggle I had was simply to try to find that balance of awakening in a deep way into the present moment, which is more for me. It's an act of surrender and receptivity rather than an effort to become. Now, you know, Amaravati is a very comfortable place. You probably haven't had even ginger doesn't attack you. What's the heaviest thing that comes at you at Amaravati? You know, maybe a rude word in the kitchen. It's a pretty soft place in that way. They're comfortable. And yet we suffer. We still experience our loves and hates and our biases and prejudices and all that. And for me, I think what's important is the idea of like Lompo Cha saying to the dogs, okay, if I've got some business with you, you can eat me, kill me. Well, maybe we don't face the howling dogs outside, but we often have to face the howling dogs inside. You know, we have to face restlessness, and loneliness and being irritated at someone or being intimidated by someone. You might face strong fears, strong feelings of loss, and, you know, all kinds of doubt, self-doubt, you know, care about Buddhism really where it's at, poly chanting, things like that. And so we're faced with our karma. And we're faced with just the endless habits and conditions of mind. And to somehow find a way of surrendering to that, not believing in it. And not thinking that one needs to fix it or get rid of it. So this is just vipaka kamma. This is just resulting kamma coming into the mind. And having a deep sense of surrender into the moment with that is where I find peace. Where I find peace, not in trying to figure out the feelings of fear, figure out the feelings of anger, or believing in the projections of fear or whatever, but actually fully surrendering to those as just vipaka kamma. If this is my kamma, if this mind state is my kamma, fine, then I accept it, let it be. And that's, for me, the practice of non-desire, and yet it fulfills the aspiration. Because the aspiration is to go beyond suffering, to go beyond the sense of self, to go to something which is more profound and more deep. So the for me at least, the continual investigation is around desire, is around tanha, around fear and desire. Because if they can be abandoned, then what is really left? What's left? Where's to go? What's to do? What's to become? What's to become? And how do we do that? How do we give up in some way? What one of the young monks in Chithurst has just made a determination to stay with Ajahn Suchita for 10 years. He said, Ajahn, you know, you really work hard, and people come and go. So on. You know, I'd like to just stay with and help you for 10 years. Oh wow, that's nice. Now what's going to happen if he sticks it out for the 10 years is that he's going to want to leave. Usually, you know, like 2 weeks later after you do want to go, if you want to get out. But what is it that's so inspiring? For me, I find it very inspiring. You know, where some young man says, well, I'm going to give something up. I'm going to offer something to you. I'm going to give something up. Try to serve you in some way. That's determination, self-surrender, renunciation, being content with what you have. Yeah? And so much of the language of our monastic training is that kind of language. You know, how do we face our vipaka kamma? It's like being content with the requisites. It's practicing profound renunciation, really giving something up. Generosity, sometimes that's not very much emphasized in monastic life, but generosity is obviously an important part of the barometers of the wholesome heart, especially like giving yourself to something like that, doing this kind of what this young monk has done. And in that there's a certain amount of joy, obviously, in that giving. But that deep surrender isn't easy. It's like really giving up. So there's the aspiration for truth, but there's giving something up. Giving up personal preferences. And then bearing with the vipaka kamma that comes to us. How are we able to go beyond the conditions and habits of fear? The conditions and habits of our projections, of our desires, if we don't just sit through them. Because as these desires and fears come up into consciousness, the conditioned response to them is, of course, to recreate them. So with my fears, I recreate them by avoidance. With my self-disparagements, I recreate it by believing in it and thinking it through. With desires, I recreate it through all kinds of fantasies. But to bear witness to these things and to surrender to them and yet stay within this lovely form, to stay within a hierarchy, to stay with people not because one likes or dislikes them, but because that's what one has surrendered to do something outside of the whole realm of personal desire, personal preferences. And as we do that, then of course the habits have a chance to cease. Habit of self, habit of fear, habit of desire, have a chance to cease in the mind. And then that cessation is peace. And there is a kind of transcendence, the realization of death. And this is not easy. My own struggles have, first of all, just been in trying to figure out what is non-desire. How does one actually just live a life of non-desire? How do you actually do that? How do you live with, you say, with fear and not desire to try to get rid of it? How do you live with anger and not judge it as being wrong? How do you live with lust and not pursue it with the mind, with fantasy, or try to repress it? Just that middle way of knowing, that can be quite a struggle in the holy life. Just figuring out what right effort without desire, without ego desire, getting that right. And that is learned through the way I've learned it, is just through mistakes, a lot of it. You try, and you make effort, and you blow it, you make mistakes. Hopefully you don't make mistakes so bad you get chucked out. But you, through wrong effort, if you're continually honoring your aspiration, then you'll see, well, that doesn't work. So in that first year, I discovered that those kinds of ascetic practices and self-mortification and very kind of macho becoming energy doesn't work. Maybe it does for some people, but it doesn't work for me. And that's the kind of insight that comes. So although one could say that was a really stupid thing to do, and yet it was profitable. It was profitable because it showed which way not to go. That's not the right path. And so people can say to me now, I should do ascetic practices, but I know what works for me. I know what's wholesome for me. I know what my mind needs and what my particular character needs. Now if I hadn't kind of just stuck with that, I hadn't just contained myself in a monastery and been able to watch that and just left whenever I felt it, just kind of followed my own mind, followed my own views and opinions, and I don't think I could get those lessons. And it is this sense of commitment and containment, day in and day out, year in and year out, where I think the profound dying happens. It's okay to stay a month or two here and there. Like lay people come here for a month or two, and it's nice, and it's a nice kind of retreat, and you get your batteries recharged, which is part of Amaravati, so people can get their batteries recharged. Or you can get long-term lay residents who kind of come and go, and they can go off here and there, and they feel a bit restless, they come and go, which is okay too. But the real guts of it, I think, the real guts of the religious life is about dying. It's about burning through some very, very difficult things. And so one has to, if we allow for the sense that we're going to feel vipaka kamma, then you have to allow for the fact that sometimes you're going to be here and you're going to hate everyone. And that's all right, as long as you live within the rules, that's fine. Or sometimes you're going to feel maybe very terrified, or you're going to feel very, very bored, or very doubtful, just fed up with it all, any kinds of negative states. And the dying to that is the full surrender to that. The full surrender to this feeling of hatred. The full surrender to this feeling of complete not knowing, or paranoia, or whatever, these strong mental states. And what the dying is, that's the dying of desire. Because desire doesn't want that. It doesn't want fear. It wants loving relationships, it wants comfort, it wants knowledge, it wants security in the known. In the unknown, in the frightening, in the unsure, in the dark, and all of that are areas that the desire doesn't go into. To fully feel fear, just to go into that feeling in a sense of presence and surrender, to fully feel anger, these kinds of things, is a kind of dying to do. But then there's a profundity to the practice. It's not kind of just a shallow kind of thing where I'm trying to be a nice monk or a nice nun. To because you're really getting to the kind of core of your condition. A life lived, say, where we just try to manipulate conditions, either the conditions of our own mind or the social conditions that we're in, a life lived of distraction can be good. It can be a good life, you know, it can be wholesome, it can be moral. But a life of entrapment, you know, a life of commitment, entrapment, whether it's marriage, children, monasticism, it doesn't really matter. But where one is faced with things that one can no longer run away from, one is just faced with the suchness of one's karma. So I know for myself, the early years of my monastic life, Ajahn Chah, he always kind of like joked with me. So in Thailand, you know, a samanera is called Nen. Nen. So they call me Nen V. So even I had been a bhikkhu for 2 years, he still called me Nen V. And Nen is always like a little boy. He's always kind of poking fun at me. And I remember so often the only thing he had to say to, you know, I'd bemoan my awful mind and my awful practice and all my awful emotions. And he'd say, "Gum, it's your karma. What do you expect?" And not in a kind of put-down way, but just, you know, I'd kind of be looking for a quick solution. "Please, Ajahn Chah, hit me with your magic wand." Or I'd try the quick solution of just fierce effort meditation and kind of break through and have this enlightened experience while never experience any kind of karma anymore. Let me just say, "Gum, just that you've come up." And now I kind of realize the depth of that simple word. Because what else could he say? What else could he say to me as my mind was full of fear or full of anger, full of lust or boredom or whatever? What's he going to say? It's your karma. Sit here. Can you bear with it? And that's not very, doesn't seem like a very deep teaching. But quite often if one is willing to say, "Well, it's just vipaka karma. You know, it's just resultant karma." And then that's what I found in Asia, that the teaching around karma is much, much more deeply imbibed, isn't it, in Asian culture. They have a tremendous amount of faith in Buddhist culture around karma. We have much more faith around analysis, figuring things out. And very often we make them very, very complicated. So, anyway, it's my own kind of take on it. But then to see, like, if difficult mind states are coming up, say there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with hatred. There's nothing wrong with fear, you know, or boredom. It's not believing in it. It's being able to stand as the witness in with determination and faith that this will change. This is not self. We use these non-theistic ways of talking about it, but you say like the theistic way, Brother Charles, where I abandon myself into your hands, do with me what you will, whatever you may do, I thank you, I am ready for all, I accept all, you know, that kind of surrender into the present moment without desire. Very hard to do. Buddhism balances faith with wisdom. Panya and Sadda. We need both. And in faith cultures, of course, where they go off is they become superstitious. And that's what I found in faith cultures, where they went off, is this kind of facile belief in things, superstition. We don't tend to have that problem. We tend to have our problem is usually doubt. But often in Westerners, where we lack strength is in the perseverance of faith. You know, as things don't go right, we think, "Oh, I'm doing something wrong." But the kind of faith in the practice, this will change, and that you are not that. That is not your essential nature, these fears or desires. That's not who you really are. to where we go off often in Western culture is our continual judgment of that as being wrong, our continual self-disparagement or put-downs of ourselves, rather than seeing it as anatta, seeing it as karma, seeing it as not self, seeing it as changing condition, seeing it as condition. Well, we tend not to have faith in that. We tend to have faith in our judgment, in our analyses, which are based often, you know, that kind of analysis based on self, from our idealism and what we've read and so on. So wisdom is a seeing clearly, not just intellectually, seeing clearly the way things are. And then the beautiful balance is that there is confidence in. There's confidence in wisdom, which is the kind of balance of faith and intelligence. So there isn't just a faith which is ungrounded, it's a faith which is grounded in having seen the way things are. Having really seen that this is a movement dependent on causes and conditions, that it does change. And so our continual the continual recommendation we have in this life is awaken, 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 awaken. This is the way it is now. Again and again and again and again. It's a simple thing, but to contemplate how often it's very difficult for people just to be in the moment. How often our minds are calculating how we're going to, where we're going to be or what we're going to do. The whole sense of bhavatana, vibhavatana, the judgment around the present moment, the becoming in the future, the dwelling in the past, but to profoundly surrender into the present moment, to give up to the present moment, whether it's awful or beautiful. This is our continual practice. Something that we continually train in. And that's the way I see it from my own practices. The more I do that, the more confidence I have that does work. The other doesn't. Becoming doesn't work for me. Trying to get rid of doesn't work for me. Self-judgment doesn't work for me. Avoidance doesn't work for me. Distraction doesn't work for me. I still do it, but it doesn't work. Manipulation doesn't work for me. All of that is simply missing the whole point of it. But what seems to work for me is like some kind of profound, it's like a profound relaxation. Isn't it? What do you think? You figure, what is non-desire, non-fear? Like non-desire around fear, even. Take that. You hear a lot of fear, anxiety, worry, these kinds of states of mind. To profoundly relax into that is hard. To relax into fear, it's almost like the things come contrary. To profoundly go into that, to be aware of that, to witness to that, without judgment and desire. So I find if I keep focus on desire, no matter what the structure of the moment is, no matter what the particular experience is, no matter what the emotional content, no matter what the storyline is, if I can be aware of tanha and really watch what I'm putting on top of this moment, the desire I had for it to the other, if I can be aware of that and then let go of that, and surrender into the moment, then things take care of themselves. And that's often hard to do because of the very complex nature of desire, the very habitual nature of it, the deeply ingrained nature. So there's this continual need to investigate so that wisdom is made more and more deep and more profound. With wisdom there's confidence. With confidence, faith becomes more and more confident. And they really conjoin into one thing, their practice. All right, I'll leave that for tonight. We have a chance to sit up till 12 for those who'd like to tonight.